gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Yes, 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 it's Professor Buzzkill here, busting myths and taking names. The filibuster and the practice of filibustering in the United States Senate is the raging topic in American politics these days. And of course, the use and abuse of history has been rampant when current politicians attack or defend the filibuster. Here, for instance, is Senator Kristen Sinema, Democrat from Arizona.
Well, as folks in Arizona know, I've long been a supporter of the filibuster because it is a tool that protects the democracy of our nation, rather than allowing our country to ricochet wildly every 2 to 4 years back and forth between policies. The idea of the filibuster was created by those who came before us, the United States Senate, to create comity and to encourage senators to find bipartisanship and work together. It was created as a tool to bring together members of different parties to find compromise and coalition. And when you think about our founding fathers, when they created the Senate with 2 senators from every state, regardless of population size, with elections staggered every, 6 years so that only a third of the body is up for election each cycle, it was designed to be a place where you cooled the passions of the House, where you work together to find that compromise, and importantly, where you protect the rights of the minority from the majority, regardless of which party is in the majority at the time.
This is a typical misunderstanding and mischaracterization of the history and development of the filibuster. Well, that's what we're here to correct. It's frankly why we get the big money. Fortunately, Buzzkillers, we have with us, as we always do, we try to get the best people on the show to talk about these things. And we have Dr. Sarah Binder, who's a professor of political science at George Washington University and a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. And perhaps most importantly for our purposes today, she's the author of Politics or Principle, Filibustering in the United States Senate, which she co-authored with Stephen Smith, but also has continued to update the Brookings Institution and Congress about the history of the filibuster. Thanks for coming on the show, Dr. Binder.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You know, what's so strange to people, I think, because this filibuster question is so dramatic at the moment, is people don't understand what it means, and they don't understand the history behind it. And you've done a great deal of myth-busting about that already. Could you tell us, first of all, what the meaning of filibuster is?
Sure. So, I mean, the filibuster is any effort to hold up the Senate, right? Whether it is blocking or delaying the Senate from getting to a vote, right? So sometimes we think it was just extended debates, but or endless amendments or repeated objections.
Right. But this isn't just an American thing. There's, an ancient history in legislative tradition of basically talking things to death. You can even talk things to death at the Thanksgiving dinner. How did it develop in the United States? Everybody seems to think it was in the Constitution. It was a founding father's idea. Can you start us there?
Sure. So if we want to narrow down why it is that senators are allowed to speak endlessly, unless a supermajority votes to cut them off, we want to start with one particular rule, and that's the distinction between the House and the Senate. The House has a rule today called the previous question motion.
Okay.
It allows a majority to cut off debate. If you look over in the Senate, you look in the rule book for previous question motion, you're not going to find it, right? The Senate, except for nominations, there is no rule that allows a majority to cut off debate. So just we can shrink down the history here. But if you look at the rule book in 1789, right, the Constitutional Convention has met several years before. The Constitution's been ratified. There's really only one real provision about the rules in the Constitution, and it says the House and Senate shall select their own rules. They start with a roughly similar rule book.
Yeah.
Both have what we now can look at and say, hey, that was a version of the previous question motion. It was in the House book and the Senate book.
Okay.
But importantly, if you look at how it was used, it did not have the effect in either the House or the Senate in the early years. It didn't have the effect of cutting off debate. And there were lots of procedural reasons why that was, But the bottom line is that in 1805, Aaron Burr, he's the vice president.
Oh, yes, very famous.
He has just the year before knocked off Alexander Hamilton, that Broadway star. He's knocked him off, but he's still the vice president. And so he gives, but he needs to get out of town, and he gives a farewell speech. And one of the things he does in that speech is he goes through the Senate rule book and says, look, if you're going to be a great deliberative body, you need a clean rule book. That's like paraphrasing. He actually singles out the previous question motion. And again, it hadn't been used to cut off debate, but he says, look, you have other rules that do the same, so drop it. And sure enough, in 1806, they come back, they clean up the rules, and they get rid of the previous question motion. Now, fine, we wouldn't have thought anything of that, except over in the House a couple years later, a very ambitious majority figures out, hey, we've got the previous question motion, and we can reinterpret how to use it, and we're going to turn it into a weapon for cutting off debate. And so the House is off and running. It's not a very, they use it to cut off debate on other rule changes they want. And so the House turns into this majority rule institution. Mm-hmm. The Senate, you know, they can look over to the House and see what they're doing in the 1810s, 1820s, no problem. 1830s, we get political parties. We get conflict over slavery and civil rights and parties themselves, partisan issues. And they realize there is no way to cut off debate because we don't have that previous question motion anymore, which precipitates almost a century of efforts until they get to cloture, to adopt the cloture rule in 1917 that allows a supermajority to cut off debate.
Okay, but in the early 19th century, Calhoun, John C. Calhoun, plays an absolutely key role. Am I right about that? Is he the first one to really figure it out and employ it in the Senate?
He's not the very, very first, but he was part right. of the early emergence of the filibuster. Okay. One thing to keep in mind about John C. Calhoun, he was serving in the House when in the majority, when they weaponized the previous question motion into a tool of cutting off debate. Right? Where you stand depends on where you sit. Once he finds himself finding that the majorities is trying to abolish slavery and end its extension into new territories, he basically becomes the root. He becomes the source of filibustering over civil rights. Keep in mind, there were filibusters over issues that were not related to civil rights.
Yes.
But by and large, civil rights becomes a major focus and major object of which senators begin to filibuster. And John C. Calhoun was every bit a part of developing the filibuster for those racially charged issues.
So does it increase in use over the 19th century? Is it a gradual thing or is it just skyrocket? What happens before 1917?
So here's the dilemma is trying to be systematic and methodical about isolating, locating, counting filibusters.
Right.
Because senators, they didn't use the term until probably the 1860s or so. You don't announce on the floor, I'm going to filibuster. Right. And so it's a little in the eye of the beholder, and the minority thinks they're just debating and the majority thinks they're obstructing getting to a vote.
Right.
But from historical counts, the sort of the main historical count of the filibuster by the end of the 19th century and early 20th says it was, he called it, there's a chapter, it's called Filibustering Unrestrained. Right? So there's it doesn't look anything like today's Senate, but compared to the 1830s and 1840s, absolutely. We do see an increase over the course of the 19th and into the early 20th century that provokes the effort to create a cloture rule so that a majority, at least then a supermajority, would be able to cut off debate.
And is that where Woodrow Wilson sort of throws his weight around and says, look, I'm not getting my stuff through, so you have to have some sort of change.
Yes, and it gets pinpointed around the question of what the U.S. was going to do in the buildup to basically the U.S. entry into the First World War.
Right.
There's one particular bill to arm merchant ships that a small group of what Wilson called a group of willful men, 11, were blocking. And that becomes the precipitating event for building enough pressure to build a large majority to create that rule, what we call the cloture rule, that gets created in 1917.
Right. Okay. Okay. And then does that sort of slow it down, or do the wars intervene and people pay attention to other things? Or does it just everybody now realizes this is something we can always use?
Well, the issue in the early years when you get through the war period is the cloture threshold is really high.
Yeah.
It's set at 2/3 of senators on the floor. And so initially, they didn't necessarily have a 2/3 vote to cut off cloture. So cloture wasn't attempted all the time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's hard to know, is it because they didn't need it or because they couldn't get it? But soon enough, we find, again, Southerners using the filibuster to block civil rights measures. Late 30s, but a little bit 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, of course, until the famous ones in the 60s, this Civil Rights Act. Why does that matter? Well, liberals in the Democratic Party and other non-conservative Republicans, they don't want to be filibustering because they want to make a moral case it's Southern racial segregationists who are exploiting the rule and the rule should be reined in. Mm-hmm. So it limits the level of filibustering really to a large degree in the middle of the 20th century to civil rights filibusters.
Right, okay.
Really, as a matter of strategy on the part of liberal Democrats. And of course, liberals, there aren't that many of them until the late 50s and early 60s. Mm-hmm. So how many filibusters there are, it depends on the nature of the parties, it depends on the nature of the agenda, and it depends on the strategy of the senators and whether or not they want a filibuster.
And I guess really the next big iceberg of a person who comes into view in this case is Strom Thurmond.
Certainly as sort of the figure who leads that longest filibuster over civil rights.
Right.
And he becomes like the emblematic symbol of what it means for a Southern segregationist senator to try to bring the Senate to its knees to block a major bill.
But I did notice, I've poked around in a number of things about this, including your own work, and it seems that there are a lot of filibusters about, well, I mean, as you say, civil rights is the biggest one and the most consistently used issue, but there are filibusters over revenue measures, there are filibusters over budgets. It's not exclusively an anti-civil rights tactic.
Right, for sure. And if we had to sort of describe them generally, we'd say there are sectional filibusters, right, that pitted the North and the South, and there are just purely partisan filibusters, right? Who should be the printer of the U.S. Senate, right? That's not really a sectional issue. That was a partisan issue.
You're kidding. They filibustered over that?
Because they could. So you see, it becomes a tool. But again, that depends on the nature of the parties.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Today, when we see fights over voting rights, for instance, right, we wouldn't call that a sectional issue because it's been absorbed into the parties. Right? Democrats tend to be for aggressive federal action, and Republicans tend to be against. So today we're much less likely to see unwind the double negative. We're more likely to see filibusters along party lines than we are along any other dimension.
Okay, now before we leave the first half of the 20th century, I do want to ask you one thing, because buzzkillers, if they know much about filibustering, they'll probably know the famous Jimmy Stewart movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, in which he filibusters by doing it the old-fashioned way, standing up and trying to talk forever. How accurate was that for the time? That's a late 1930s movie. Or is it just that completely romanticized? I mean, I'm sure it was completely romanticized, but how does it stand in sort of Senate history as an example?
We don't always have the theatrics of Jimmy Stewart and, the mobs, the ladies in the bonnets in the galleries. But the idea that senators would have to take the floor and continue to debate and hold on to debate and not yield to the other party, that's a very real part of Senate history.
Okay.
Whether we're in the 19th century or whether we're in early to mid 20th century. Now, having said that, those really disappear in the very early 1970s.
Right.
We get replaced. They didn't call it, these are all modern terms, right? The silent filibuster versus the talking filibuster. And that's a modern term because they were all really talking filibusters, right? For anyone who's read Robert Caro's The Master of the Senate book, where he talks about the 57 and the 64 civil rights filibuster, I guess the 57, and the amount of months and times that it took before they're anywhere near cloture on that bill. That was a talking filibuster without the theatrics of Jimmy Stewart. It goes away, in essence, by 1970. You have parties here, which is compared to today, not a terribly partisan Senate, right? Uh-huh. We have liberal Republicans, we have conservative Republicans, we have conservative Democrats, we have liberal Democrats. Mm-hmm. And so there's much more ideological disagreement and conflict within the parties, let alone between the parties. And there's just a lot of effort to gum up the works on the floor. And so the two the two leaders, Mansfield, who was the majority leader, and I think it was Hugh Scott, the minority leader, they basically work out an agreement, which is just like we do today. The leaders made a unanimous consent agreement to structure the floor in a way that if there was a filibuster going on the floor on a particular bill, let's say it's a bill to establish the EPA, it's the early 1970s.
Right.
And leaders know that there's going to be an effort to be drawn out that could be a filibuster, could be trying to prevent a vote to block cloture. The agreement was that the Senate would just move on to another issue and just leave that other bill pending back there on one track and then move the Senate on to a new track. So they called it tracking or dual track two-track system. What happened when you did that? Well, it became very easy. All you had to do really was threaten to filibuster, and the leaders might negotiate a consent agreement to move on to the second track on a bill that they thought they might be able to get more traction on, rather than allowing the majority and forcing the majority to spend all its time on one bill at the expense of the rest of their agenda.
Yeah, but doesn't that sort of put, this seems to me to be the absolute central problem that we have nowadays. It starts right here, because that means if there are two tracks, that means the track where there's a threatened filibuster, that bill sort of never happens. And since you're not forced to Jimmy Stewart it by standing up and talking, it can just sit there dormant while the other stuff in the Senate goes on.
And I think that has been one of the refrains of senators, of Senate reformers, many of them today, which is to say there's not enough burden on the minority to actually block a bill through effort, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The burden is really on the majority to muster what we now require 60 votes for cloture. In many ways, I think that is true, right? If we want to think about, like, what's the real difference between a talking filibuster and a silent filibuster?
Right.
The old filibusters, many people who write about the filibuster will call it a war of attrition. Like, which is the last team that's going to be standing, right? Which team is really going to be the one at the end of the day is going to outlast the obstruction, or the obstructing ones? Do those senators care so much about that issue that they're just never going to give up?
Right.
That is a war of attrition, right? Which is the last team standing? Today, instead of doing that, leaders just file cloture, right? We saw it with the January 6th, with the measure to create a commission to investigate the insurrection of January 6th, right? There wasn't any long debates went on the floor. They barely debated it. They filed cloture.
Cloture in this sense means that, I suppose, the majority party, in this case the Democrats, agrees to stop debate because they know they can't get any further with it. Because there's a threatened filibuster, is that right?
Yeah. I think one way to think about it is to step back a second, right? Over in the House, they just basically filed, they used the previous question to cut off debate and figure out when the votes are going to be. The Senate, they really have two options. They can look around and they could negotiate an agreement. 100 senators, let's vote at 2 p.m. Let's allow 6 amendments, right? They can negotiate that all, or a leader can file cloture to get 60 votes to cut off debate and then allows some degree of figuring out when the votes are going to be. But they're otherwise, and we have to get into the nitty-gritty of Senate rules where we don't want to go. Otherwise, we would say that there really isn't a motion in the Senate rules that allow a majority to decide to cut off debate.
Wow.
And that's what leaves them struggling here and relying on cloture, which many people say, well, the burden is on the majority. They have to produce the 60 votes because the rule says 3/5 of all senators.
Right.
And then, in theory, relatively easy for the minority. It's not up to them to deliver 41 votes to block it. It's up to the majority to demonstrate there's enough votes to move on to cut off debate.
And that's why they can do it, in effect, silently. And I'm putting silent in quotation marks.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
Now, listeners have asked me, when they Google filibuster and they Google history of filibuster, they see that a lot of charts and images that show the number of filibusters just sort of really, really ramping up. So, really, as I said, iceberg style or Rocky Mountain style. in the late 20th century, early 21st century. Is that accurate? Is that really what's happened?
I think it's important to keep one thing in mind first. Those charts are counts of cloture motions, and typically cloture motions filed. Like, how many times did the leader file cloture in order to cut off debate? Mm-hmm. Now, it's not a bad metric for figuring out how much filibustering is going on, but neither is it a direct measure.
Oh, okay.
And so when the minority party looks at those measures, regardless of who's in the minority, they will say, well, those weren't filibusters. The leader filed cloture before we'd had a chance to get a guarantee we'd be able to offer amendments. Or the leader slapped down cloture just to make sure he knew what time everybody was going to take a vote. We weren't going to filibuster. So that's one scenario, right? It's possible that that measure overcounts filibustering. Having just to be clear, though.
I was just going to say, could this get any more complicated?
Well, it's also possible that those cloture motions undercount filibusters.
Oh.
Right? Okay. Right. Just to make sure, to make life complicated for people like me who like to count.
So the graphs could be undercounting or they could be overcounting.
So I think it's fair to say there's a lot more use of cloture than there used to be. And there's certainly lots of threats to filibuster, right? The leader asks unanimous consent and somebody objects.
Right, right.
And then they file cloture. Was that a filibuster? Well, it's a threat to filibuster.
Yeah.
But yes, there's been this, if you look at it, exponential rise. And I think part of that is that the parties themselves, even if there are disagreements within the parties, there are a lot of disagreements between the two parties about what the issues are, whether or not they should be debated. So climate change, immigration, gun control, all these issues that are on the national agenda, you need a supermajority to actually put them on the floor.
Okay.
And the more partisan the Senate gets, the more they think that, you know, control of the chamber is just around the corner if we can make the other party look bad, which many people attribute directly to Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, right? Because he said it on the
he said it many times during the, he's brazen about it. Well, Obama, I shouldn't say brazen because I'll sound partisan, but he's very open about it.
Exactly. And so the more competition there is in the Senate, the more partisanship, the more routine the use of cloture has been. And that's why you get in that those graphs these exponential increases in the use of cloture, and which we think is capturing the aggressiveness of minority parties willing to filibuster.
Okay, what do you see? I mean, so many people are asking for the filibuster to be eliminated or stopped or go back to the talking filibuster. I know analysts and historians in political science don't like to predict the future, but what do you think you see for the next, say, generation in the Senate? What might happen to the filibuster?
So here's what we do know, that if we look at the history of the cloture rule, so this Rule 22, if we look at the last 100 plus years of Senate history, each of the changes in Senate rules have generally made it easier to invoke cloture and made it a more effective tool and streamlined how much time it takes, right? And when there have been efforts to use the nuclear option, it has similarly basically reined in many of the excesses of obstruction in the Senate. So I see this as the Senate's sort of long march towards majority rule.
Right.
Right. If we can think of that long arc bending incrementally, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly towards majority rule. Will they actually make it to majority rule? Well, they've done it on nominations. And nobody up until, well, certainly I was surprised, and I was glued to C-SPAN that day.
Up until
November, whatever the date was, 2013, I think a lot of people doubted that Harry Reid, the majority leader, had the votes to wipe out nomination filibusters. So we can't be too confident that it won't happen. At the same point, though, now that it's crystallized that this is like what we now call the legislative filibuster, that this is like the last stand of the filibuster, I think there's probably some reluctant, certainly this time, Democratic senators, even beyond Manchin and Sinema. But the long movement here is towards majority rule. And who knows, in a decade, I don't know. But I wouldn't eliminate the possibility that there could be more changes to the cloture rule along the way.
Okay, let me ask one final question. I think that the filibuster is something that people have their own opinions on in terms of their own, of the validity of it, or of the historical nature of it, the constitutionality of it, the tradition of it. One of the things we like to do at the Buzzkill Institute is we like to show our listeners what it's like to be a researcher actually working on these things, but also being a normal human being out in the rest of the world who has to, who votes or who talks about politics or has their own opinions on things. So what's it like being an expert on this and having to try to understand all this incredible detail? But yet, I'm just guessing here, you probably have an opinion on whether it should stay or it should go. Is there a kind of a professional, personal, political tension going inside you all when you're working on stuff like this?
I usually always try to keep my political science hat on.
Good. Well, yeah, we do that too.
The way I think about it is really this way, is that the issue or the quote-unquote problem of the filibuster is that it prevents the Senate from getting to a vote, right?
Right.
And oftentimes you can filibuster, it's the motion to call up a bill where the Senate isn't even on, you can filibuster whether or not they should put the bill on the agenda. And what does it mean not to cast votes? Like, voting is like a sort of a core element of accountability in the legislature. Like, you and I really should know how lawmakers vote. And what the filibuster is doing is preventing that type of transparency and accountability. And so it is certainly the case that different parties' ox is being gored or will be gored by abolishing the filibuster altogether. But that's why I keep my political science hat on and say, look, if we care about legislatures as having public legitimacy and democratic legitimacy, yeah, they have to cast votes, right? And that at root to me is what the problem is with the filibuster.
Yeah, we send them to Congress, to the reps or to the Senate, to do just that.
One would hope.
Well, Professor, this has been one of our best shows, and you've cleared up so many things, not only for me, but for our listeners. So it just remains for me to say thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We, of course, will put links to your webpage and to your Brookings Institute page and some of the articles you've written on the filibuster on our blog post for this episode.
Great. Enjoyed trying to clear the air, as it were.
Well, it's a lot clearer for me, and I hope it's a lot clearer for our listeners.
Awesome.
So there you have it, Buzzkillers. The filibuster is complicated, complicated, complicated. But before we go, I'd like to remind everyone to go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com for all the info on the show, to read the blog posts, to catch up on past episodes, follow us on social media, and support the Buzzkill Institute on Patreon. Please become a part of the solution to history myths and misconceptions rather than perpetuating the problem of these historical urban legends like about the filibuster. History is complex, but it's also compelling. And when we study it more fully, we can come to a better understanding of ourselves, our societies, and perhaps even our future. Talk to you next week.